So you can go ahead and open your Bible to the book of Ezekiel. And we're going to begin a series tonight. I don't know whether this will hang here or not. We'll try it. Looking at the book of Ezekiel. So tonight is going to be very much a 30,000-foot view, just to kind of take a look at what is contained in the book, how it's organized, who wrote it, some things like that. And then we're going to begin to kind of swoop in and start with kind of the first section tonight, but just to very briefly move into it. Ezekiel, as you probably know if you've read it, is one of the longest books in the Bible. I think there are four that are longer. You got Psalms, of course. You've got Genesis, which is longer. You've got Isaiah and Jeremiah, which are longer in terms of number of chapters and number of pages anyway. And I don't know about you, but I don't recall hearing much teaching on the book of Ezekiel. I think it's a shame when we exclude certain passages of Scripture for whatever reason. And I wonder on this one, is it because of the length? Is it because of some complexities? There certainly are some complexities, and there are going to be some things that you may have wondered about. And when we get through this series, you're probably still going to be wondering about it, such as the temple all the aspects to the temple, and why are sacrifices being offered in that, what many call the third temple, and those type things. But hopefully we can get a sense of what the Lord was saying as he spoke through this man, Ezekiel. And so we're going to attempt not to do a verse by verse, because we would be here for the next 30 years probably. But again, we are going to attempt to get a sense of what's contained here, what the basic subjects are, and some of the principles that I think we can draw from those things. So tonight we're going to start by looking at the setting. And so I should have told you not to turn to Ezekiel. Put your finger there and turn back to 2 Chronicles chapter 36. And I'm not going to go into a great deal of background detail, primarily because Dave is teaching on the book of Daniel. And these two were, compatriots? They were ministering at about the same time. We don't have any evidence that they knew each other, but they were ministering at about the same time. And so the background that Dave gave, and he gave fairly extensive background to the book of Daniel. Go back and listen to that. And that's going to give you a lot of the background here. We're going to touch on it tonight, but I'm not going to go into as much detail. So 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and we are going to read verses 1 through 21, just because it sets the stage for what was happening in Israel when this when God began to speak through this man, Ezekiel. I'm reading in the ESV. The people of the land took Jehoaz, the son of Josiah, and made him king in his father's place in Jerusalem. And you remember Josiah. He was the one that at a young age began a godly reign, really the last one of the kings of the southern tribes. And so he did some pretty phenomenal things. But then immediately upon his death, the kings reverted to their wicked ways, and the people readily followed along with them. So his son, Jehoaz, was made king in his place. Jehoaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. Then the king of Egypt deposed him in Jerusalem and laid on the land a tribute of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. And the king of Egypt made Eliakim, his brother, king over Judah and Jerusalem, and changed his name to Jehoiakim with an M at the end. But Necho took Jehoaz, his brother, and carried him to Egypt. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. But he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. Against him came up Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and bound him in chains to take him to Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar also carried part of the vessels of the house of the Lord to Babylon and put them in his palace in Babylon. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and the abominations that he did and what was found against him, behold, they are written in the book of the kings of Israel and Judah. And Jehoiakim, with an N, his son, reigned in his place. Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months and 10 days in Jerusalem. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, and in the spring of the year, King Nebuchadnezzar sent and brought him to Babylon with precious vessels from the house of the Lord and made his brother Zedekiah king over Judah and Jerusalem. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by God. He stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel. All the officers and the priests and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of the Lord that he had made holy in Jerusalem. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people, until there was no remedy. Therefore he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with a sword, in the house of their sanctuary, and had no compassion on young man or virgin, old man or aged. He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burned the house of God, and broke down the wall of Jerusalem, and burned all its palaces with fire, and destroyed all its precious vessels. He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the king of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. So there we see these last few kings, and it was a time of great turmoil in Israel. Started with the king of Egypt coming up and basically creating a vassal state, if you will. And then as Nebuchadnezzar began his effort to take over the world, he moved into that area. He pushed back the king of Egypt, in essence confined him to Egypt, and he began to control this land. But we see three different kings that were involved in that picture. And so I've got a timeline that depicts some of this, and I'm going to use a pointer. They say a picture is worth 1,000 words. This one might be worth 150. We'll see. But you see a lot of stuff here. And so to start with, you see the beginning of the work of Ezekiel. And it's somewhere in the range of 593 or so BC. So that's when he began to be spoken to by the Lord, and he began to minister. Now, a couple of things that are important. You see also that Daniel was engaged in his career and certainly spoke to some degree as a prophet, starting earlier than Ezekiel. And because of that, many people think he was carried captive in the very first effort that Nebuchadnezzar came in and took some people captive. He took some of the elite of the country captive to use them in his palace for advisors and things like that. Now, we're not really told when Ezekiel was taken, We know he was taken before this third attack that destroyed the city, because one of the revelations in the book of Ezekiel was somebody came to him and told him that that had happened. So we know he was already there when that happened. So he either went when Daniel went, or he went this second time during the reign of Zedekiah, or really the time when Zedekiah was installed on the throne by Nebuchadnezzar. And so you see the nation of Israel here as a power, basically being eliminated with the destruction of Jerusalem and their temple and moving over into captivity, which is reflected by this section up here. You see Egypt, which is, doesn't show up very well. Yeah, this is a green section. This is Egypt and the rule of Egypt. This is Assyria and Babylon up here. And so you see that the Babylonian Empire took over from the Assyrian Empire way back here about 620-something B.C., okay? And then Nebuchadnezzar began his reign right in here, and this was his father, I believe. Somebody pronounce that for me. Nebuchadnezzar, something like that, okay? And so that just gives you the big picture of what was happening there. And so with that, let's look at Ezekiel chapter 1. And a couple of things are going to be somewhat apparent by having that up there. So we're going to read the first three verses of Ezekiel chapter 1, which will tie back into some of what we read in 2 Chronicles. It says, "In the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, I was among the exiles by the Chebar Canal. The heavens were open, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the Chebar Canal, and the hand of the Lord was upon him." Now, the exile of Jehoiakim started at the same time that Zedekiah was installed as king. Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiakim, took him with him to Babylon, and put Zedekiah in his place, again, to be a vassal king. So that's this period right here. And some people think that's the time that Ezekiel went to Babylon. And so we find him in this situation in Babylon, which is now modern-day Iraq. So you can get a sense of where that was. He's at a place called the Chebar Canal, and he is with other Israelites there. And so that's where the Lord begins to talk to him. So it was in the fifth year, so somewhere, again, right in here, would be about the fifth year of Zedekiah's reign, and that's where this line comes down, and you see Ezekiel being used at that time. So let's think about this man, Ezekiel. First of all, it's pretty clear from the passage here what his profession was. What did it say he was? He was a priest. So he had been trained as a priest. Now, it started off in verse 1. It said, in the 30th year. But it really doesn't make it clear exactly the 30th year of what. It's not the 30th year of Jehoiakim's exile. It's the fifth year of his exile. So there are two or three possibilities, and we can't be dogmatic about them. Some people think, and this one to me seems to have the less merit, some people think that that was 30 years from the date that Josiah discovered the book of the law and it was read. And in fact, it was about 30 years from that date, but it's a little bit hard to think why that would be a specific mark in the sand to start to date time from. There are others who think it was about 30 years from when Nabopolassar took the reign and the Babylonian Empire really began to emerge as a world power and Assyria began to diminish. So that's certainly a possibility. The timelines that they have indicated, it's not exactly 30 years. So that has some weakness there. There are others that think this is talking about his age, that he was in his 30th year. And that may have some merit. And the reason I think that may have some merit is that in Israel, if you go back to Numbers chapter 4, the priest began to serve when they were how old? When they were 30 years old. So if that's what this is talking about, and it's a good possibility, Ezekiel was just moving in to his role as an active priest. Now, before we go into that, because there are a couple points I want to make, I want to consider for a minute his name. His name is Ezekiel, and it actually means strengthened of God. Strengthened of God. And we're going to find in a few minutes where God declares that he had, in fact, strengthened Ezekiel for the work that he had for him. But then you have to think, okay, so how did his parents know that? They named him. How did they name him that with that in mind? Well, we don't know. I can't tell you that. But perhaps God gave them the name. He's done that before with other men that had significance that were going to be prophets. And so perhaps Ezekiel's name was one that had been given to his parents by God because of the work that God was going to call him to. It was going to be a hard work, and we're going to see that. I think a lot of times we tend to feel like we have it tough. Well, we ain't seen nothing compared to what Ezekiel had to live through. And you're going to see that as we go through the book. So, perhaps it is the 30th year. Again, I'm going to point out there are a couple of things that might weaken that, but that seems to be the strongest argument for what he's talking about here. But in 1 Corinthians 23 and Ezra 3, that's a later time. The service of priest actually was moved back to 20 years. We're not told why. We're not told whether there was a shortage of priests and so they decided to recruit them earlier, or was it because they were no longer lugging this stuff through the desert and carrying it from place to place so that the physical dimensions of their work had been diminished. It was now more or less a single place. The priests were really scattered throughout Israel, and they were simply serving the people as they attempted to worship God. So we're not 100% sure about that, but I just wanted to point out that it was originally 30, and then it seemed to move to 20 in those later times. But I think one thing is clear. The assignment that Ezekiel gets at the beginning of this book is probably not at all what Ezekiel thought he was going to be doing. He was trained as a priest. He was from the line of priests. I'm sure he thought that was going to be his primary role. And I want you to think for just a minute the difference between a priest and a prophet. There were other priests that were prophets. Jeremiah was a priest that was a prophet. Zechariah was a priest that was a prophet. John the Baptist was apparently a priest that was a prophet. So there were other people that were priests that were prophets. But what was the general attitude towards prophets? Poor. Poor. Okay. They were the ones that got killed. Okay, they were the ones that got killed because of the message that they were giving out. The priests generally didn't have that same kind of danger in their life. In fact, I think some would say they tended to be respected. They might have had it difficult because their income was to come from the faithful giving of the people. And as the people went away from God, that diminished. So the priest very often would suffer from poverty, but they didn't typically suffer from people hating them, despising their message, and wanting to kill them. So I want you just to think about that as we think about this call on his life, this was probably not at all what he expected his life to be. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. Do you think it was hard for Ezekiel to know what his call was? Anybody got a guess? Jan? It was pretty obvious, wasn't it? I mean, God appeared to Ezekiel in a way that he has not appeared to anybody else. The full-fledged display that we're going to look at in a week or so of the glory of God that Ezekiel was confronted with when he was given his assignment. I mean, it was like God standing in front of you in all his glory and saying, "Ray, here's what I want you to do." Now, my point is this. I think, my opinion, there are times where God makes his direction for us that clear. And I think that often those are times when that direction is a change of direction from what we may be doing or what we may be thinking. So I think there are times, there are people who live their life and they start out and they start pursuing something and God is saying, "Yes, that's what I want you doing. Keep doing it." But then there are other times where you begin and you start to pursue something and then God says, "I want you to go this way." And I personally think he makes it clear to us. We won't see the glory of God like Ezekiel did, I don't think. Okay? But I think he has ways to make it clear to us when he is trying to direct us toward a specific work. Now, let's think about the message that he has. And we're not going to look at the specifics of it because we're going to get into that in the future. But we're going to see that the big picture, the Cliff Note version, was that it's a message of judgment and hope. And so an awful lot of the book is taken up of Ezekiel declaring the word of God both towards Israel and towards their surrounding enemies, and he's declaring judgment. And in fact, they were living through it because this was pretty serious judgment going on right here. So when Ezekiel started to speak, they were already in the midst of the judgment. But the amazing thing is there were many that would tell them that it wasn't a big deal. There were prophets that would say, "Oh no, this isn't the work of God. This is all going to come to pass very quickly." But God was bringing judgment, and so Ezekiel's message was one of judgment. But then as we get towards the end of the book, it looks forward, and it's one of hope. And we have all kinds of prophecies in here of Israel's future being a glorious future. And I think the simple reading of the scripture is that is talking about Israel, not the church. So that's the Cliff Notes version. A more detailed look. If you go through the book of Ezekiel, you'll find that these messages were delivered to him over a 22-year period of time. So again, this wasn't a single moment in time where God spoke to him. He spoke to him apparently 13 different times. And those times are recorded in the book of Ezekiel. Isaiah, we talked about it. Isaiah worked during the reigns of four different kings. And to me, the book of Isaiah can be one of the most difficult to go through because it's not chronological and it's not organized by topic. And as we looked at that a couple years ago, we realized that if you were being given a message over a sustained period of time, little bits at a time, and you were writing that down, it probably wouldn't be organized in a fashion that a reader could just sit down and say, oh, okay, it's exactly this. So we looked at that and we went through it and we saw certain recurring subjects and topics that seemed to pop up. And we considered those topics. Now, Ezekiel is a little bit kinder to us. Most of what we have here is presented largely in chronological order. There are a couple of exceptions, and we'll see that in a minute. So 13 different recorded messages. And we're going to look at a couple of examples, not in detail, but just to establish the pattern. So again, back here in verse 2, we see this. On the fifth day of the month, it was the fifth year of the exile of King Jehoiakim, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel. So a bit of a pattern. It identifies the year based on Jehoiakim's exile and the month. Look forward to Ezekiel chapter 8, verse 1. This is the second time we see that same kind of phraseology. In the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I sat in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, the hand of the Lord fell upon me there. So, if you go through the book, you will find 13 instances where that wording is repeated. On a certain year, in terms of Jehoiakim's exile, a certain month, a certain day of the month, the word of the Lord came to him. And then he spoke what he heard. Now within that, you will find a number that you see some of these are pretty long, going from chapter 8 to chapter 20. Makes up, what, at least a third of the book. Within that, there are object lessons that he was told to display. There were individual stories he was told to tell, individual messages that he was told to tell, but it all came in that one revelation. Now, we read, if you go back and read the history, right here in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign is when Nebuchadnezzar was fed up. He had already gone and attacked them twice, and Zedekiah is now rebelling against him, and he goes and he lays siege to the city. And that's the siege that ultimately leads in the total destruction of Jerusalem about the 11th year, and you see a number of revelations there. It's the 12th year, one of these, when Ezekiel got word in Babylon that Jerusalem had fallen. So these revelations that are occurring in that period of time. This one is slightly out of order, and there seems to be a reason for it. We'll get into that down the road. But most of the other ones are largely in chronological sequence as you go through the book. And so one point I want to make, one principle of Bible study. When you see something repeated a number of times, generally it means to take note of it, to try to figure out why that's there. Now, I am not telling you that this is some mystical key to understanding the book of Ezekiel. But I found it helpful to be able to break this big book down into these specific instances to have a better understanding of what the messages were in each of those cases. And so that's something. There's something else that's repeated, and honestly, I can't give you the full understanding at least yet. Ezekiel is called by God, Son of Man, 80-some times. Like, I think it's 83 times. Only one other man in the Old Testament is called Son of Man. That's Daniel one time. And then we also know who else had that title. Now, I'm not sure I get the connection. I'm not sure why Ezekiel, why when God spoke to him, he basically said, Son of Adam, I'm going to speak to you. Perhaps it was because Ezekiel needed to recognize that the God of heaven, the one that displayed his glory, was stepping down to work through a son of Adam to reach his people. I don't know, but it's significant that it's repeated that many times. So, one thing that perhaps we can deduce from this. All through this, Israel was in disobedience. Israel was in rebellion. Look at how many times God just continued to speak. It wasn't one big data dump. It was all these multiple messages over a 20-year period that God continued to reveal what He wanted to hear. I think that tells us something about the heart of God, about His desire to call His people back, His desire to make His message clear to His people. And so I think we see that reflected here in the book of Ezekiel. Now, the overall outline, condensing this into something considerably more meaningful, I think it breaks into four basic parts. Chapters 1 through 3 is what I would say God's call to Ezekiel. This is this dialogue that takes place, this dramatic demonstration by God to tell Ezekiel what his assignment is going to be. Then in chapters 4 through 23, he goes through and he spells out time after time the sin of the nation of Israel and the judgment that God is bringing and is going to bring on them. But he doesn't leave it at that. Chapter 24 through 32, he spells out his judgment on all of the surrounding enemies. So he picks up on Egypt. He picks up on Moab, on Ammon, on Edom, on Elam, on Tyre and Sidon, spending a significant amount of time declaring judgment on Tyre. Now, we might think, well, why would he do that? But we'll begin to see that as we look into it. So he declares God's judgment on Israel's enemies. And then the last 15 or so chapters, he presents Israel's future. And he presents the fact that it's going to be a glorious future. So let's look, dive down a little bit into this first section. Again, staying pretty much in those first three chapters, and we're certainly not going to deal with everything there. We'll come back next time and pick up some of this. But there are a few characteristics that I think we see of God's call or God's commission to Israel. First one we've already talked about, so I won't belabor it. In verse 1, I would say it was unmistakable. Notice what happened. He's sitting there, or he's fishing, or he's bathing, or he's doing something by the Chebar River with other people. And the heavens open. Now that's pretty dramatic. When God wanted to get his attention, you know, I mean, Moses got a burning bush. Ezekiel got the heavens roll back. And we're going to see what he saw was an absolutely phenomenal sight. We'll take that up next time. So his call was absolutely unmistakable. We think of others. Moses, I mentioned. Isaiah, he saw a vision. Paul, he saw the light from heaven. In many cases, God made such a clear declaration to people that he was calling for a specific work. So his call was unmistakable. I think a key thing there is it really left Ezekiel only with one decision. Do I obey or do I disobey? Now, who does that bring to mind? How about Jonah? God's call on Jonah was equally clear. Jonah chose to disobey, and he regretted it. Ezekiel chooses to obey. So that's key. The next thing we see in verse 3, the last phrase of that verse, it says, the hand of the Lord was upon him there. And if you find that phrase in the Old Testament, it generally seems to represent God's enablement to do a work. Ezra, in his journey from captivity back to Jerusalem to help with the rebuilding project, he said a number of times, the good hand of the Lord was upon us. So God was enabling them to accomplish what he was calling them to do. So here we see that his hand was upon him. Look down in verse 7 and 8 of chapter 3. It says, "But the house of Israel will not be willing to listen to you, for they are not willing to listen to me. Because all the house of Israel have a hard forehead and a stubborn heart." So he was going to need God's help to be able to do this work. We'll look at that a little bit more in a minute. I think the next thing is that he was empowered by the Spirit of God. Again, back to verse 2, verse 2. "And he said to me, 'Son of man, stand on your feet, and I will speak with you.' And as he spoke to me, the Spirit entered into me and set me on my feet, and I heard him speaking to me." So the Spirit of God entered into Ezekiel. And we know in the Old Testament, the Spirit of God entered into people on a select basis. There was not a group of people like the church who had the indwelling Spirit as a permanent thing. But when God was working through people, he would put his Spirit within them. And so he does that with Ezekiel. And I think the key thing that came to my mind there is what Jesus says over in John 15:5. He was in process of commissioning his disciples. He was in the upper room and he was telling them what was coming. He was telling them what they were going to be doing. And he says this, he says, "I am the vine, you are the branches. Whosoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing." Nothing. As we go about the work of God, and I'm not talking just about in the official terms, when we're at church, when we're this, when we're going out with Bible school circuits, we should be about the work of God in whatever we're doing. So if you are a teacher, you're about the work of God, how you relate to those students, how you impact those students. You know, whatever we do, God has called us to do it with all of our vigor, with all of our energy, as unto Him. And so we are working for Him, and we cannot accomplish anything that has eternal value without the power of His Spirit. We can get caught up in going through the motions. Some people say that when the rapture occurs, some church is just going to keep on going. They're going to keep doing what they're doing. You know, I hope that's not at all the case here. But it could be if we're doing what we're doing simply because we think that's what we ought to do. But we need the Holy Spirit of God to empower us to do these things. Now, I want to go back to one point because I forgot something. On the second point, he was preparing Ezekiel for the work. He had his hand upon him. That was one way he was preparing him. The other way is down there at the second part of that verse 8, when he talked about how hard-hearted Israel was. He says, look at what he says to Ezekiel. "I have made your face as hard as their faces, and your forehead as hard as their foreheads." Now, he's not saying he had made him hard-hearted against God. But he's saying, you're going up against a stubborn bunch of people. And guess what? I've made you just as stubborn in a good way. He had done everything within Ezekiel to equip him for the work that he called him for. And I think that's a pretty basic principle. If he is calling you to do something, He's going to equip you to do it. And just as Ezekiel might have looked at this and said, there's no way I can do that. I'm a priest. I'm not a prophet. God's telling right up front, Ezekiel, I've already taken care of it. I've already done everything you need within you to equip you and to prepare you to do the work that I've called you to do. And then the last thing. This call was non-negotiable. We get a glimpse of that in chapter 2, verse 8. It says, but you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Be not rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give you. So he told him, he said, I've got to work for you. And it's going to be real easy for you to turn back. It's going to be real easy for you to want to quit. But don't do it. Don't be rebellious like they've been rebellious. So this calling was not laying out an option for him. It wasn't saying, hey, I've got an idea. I want to think what you think about it, Ezekiel. He was saying, I've got to work for you. I've prepared you for it. I'm going to be with you through my spirit. And the hard part was, guess what? Nobody's going to listen to you, Ezekiel. He tells him right up front, they're not going to listen to you. But that didn't give him a right to turn and stop. It was non-negotiable. So that's all we're going to look at tonight. Next time, we will dive in a little bit to this vision that he saw. We're going to consider what that might mean. Again, when you think about it, God didn't reveal himself like that to any other prophet. Now, Isaiah saw a vision, but not like this vision. Not as massive as this vision. So I think we have to ask, well, why is that? Why did God, I mean, sometimes he just spoke. Sometimes he just gave a dream. Sometimes he sent an angel. We may not be able to answer why, but we can think about it. Why did he speak to Ezekiel in such a way? And we'll look at that next time.